Thank you for joining me for Quite Excellent, episode number 77. Our poem this week continues a trajectory that the semester kind of started, with complex relationships being at the center of each poem in some way. We are back looking at friendships again, but in a direction change. These aren't so happy this time around. Relationships are complicated, and they don't always last, but that doesn't make them less important. Our poem is Message to a Former Friend by Tony Hoagland, and it was originally published in The Sun magazine in August of 2015. I'm not entirely sure how I came upon this poem, but it is quite possible that it was passed to me by Reed English teacher Terry DeBarger. I don't know that for sure, but I don't follow The Sun like he does, and almost every poem I have been fortunate enough to read from that magazine has been the result of Terry kindly passing in my way. Before we get to our next poem, we must revisit Mother Talks Back to the Monster by Carrie Shipers. It is read by me this time. Mother Talks Back to the Monster by Carrie Shipers. Tonight, I dressed my son in astronaut pajamas, kissed his forehead, and tucked him in. I turned on his nightlight and looked for you in the closet and under the bed. I told him you were nowhere to be found, but I could smell your breath, your musty fur. I remember all your tricks, the jagged shadows on the wall, click of your claws, the hand that hovered just above my ankles if I left them exposed. Since I became a parent, I see danger everywhere. Unleashed dogs, sudden fevers, cereal 2 days out of date. And even worse than feeling so much fear is keeping it inside, trying not to let my love become so tangled with anxiety my son thinks they're the same. When he says he's seen your tail or heard your heavy step, I insist that you aren't real. Soon he'll feel too old to tell me his bad dreams. If you get lonely after he's asleep, you can always come downstairs. I'll be sitting at the kitchen table with the dishes I should wash, crumbs I should wipe up. We can drink hot tea and talk about the future, how hard it is to be outgrown. As always, students had a lot of great things to say about our poetry. I was really impressed with what they had to do this time. I think a good place to start is with the discussion of how students perceived the mother themselves. And one student caught something that no one else did that I hadn't even considered, and I think it's a great place to start. They wrote that, I see her as a single mom, which is why the only people she talks about are her monster and her son. There is no other figure to help her, which is why she stresses so much. I think this is a great catch, because many parents experience the kind of things that are happening in this poem, but a single parent experiences them so much more, because everything rides on them. They have the full weight of fear and hope and everything that comes with having a child. And it's a great place to start, because with that as our understanding of our speaker, everything else I think has meaningful context. At least one student suggested that this is a new mother, someone who's only recently had a child, but there was quite a lot of disagreement over this idea, and a representative response to it was a student that said, there was never any concrete evidence to show us that the speaker was a newish mother. We only truly see the mother and or the speaker is slightly experienced in the matter, with the proof being, since I became a parent, I see danger everywhere. And this shows that she has grown and is still growing. And I think it's reasonable to see this as a newer mother, especially because of how innocent and vulnerable the child seems to be. And that's expressed well by another student who writes, there's a sense of innocence in how it is addressed that she, quote, dressed my son in astronaut pajamas. The fact that she's the one doing the dressing, the fact that they're astronaut pajamas, all of those speak to the innocence of the child and therefore maybe how young the child is. But I tend to agree that this doesn't necessarily need to be a new parent. I don't think a new parent's at a place where they're thinking about being forgotten, or at least no longer being essential in the same way they used to be. Next part of this has got to be, though, so what's the monster? Who is the monster? A student writes that the monster is being revealed because of the jagged shadows on the wall. This visual imagery shows the danger and scariness of the monster. Another writes that the monster is likely not a monster at all, but a representation of fear. For most people, fear is like facing a monster head on. For the speaker, she knows the monster exists, but tries to hide it from her son. Another writes, the mother then describes danger as having musty fur. If something is musty, it's been around for a long time and is on poor or rotten condition. This phrase could reflect the idea that the mother thinks of danger as something ugly that has been around for a long time, and everyone has to face it because it isn't going anywhere. And this idea of danger as a fundamental part of the poem, I think, is important. And I've broken up this idea because I think students were really interested in exploring the difficulties of being a parent, which I didn't really expect going into this poem. But I like that. I like the sympathetic view of parents that my students were offering. So the first place is the difficulties of being a parent, part one, the real dangers. A student writes that danger is an ordinary part of life, but it is intensified as a child. And even the mother says so as, quote, she sees danger everywhere. It uses the visual and olfactory imagery of the monster's breath, jagged shadows on walls, and hand over her ankles as she sleeps, to minor or non-existent dangers, like expired cereal, unleashed dogs, and sudden fears. A student says that the mother first revealed her anxiousness when she told her son that the monster was nowhere to be found, but she could still smell the breath and the musty fur of the beast. In these lines, Schipers uses the monster to represent the mother's worries about her child. Even though the mother reassured herself of the monster, or in other words, danger, was not near her child, she could still feel that risk was near. Another notes that she looks out for, quote, unleashed dogs and, quote, sudden fevers, which are things adults worry about, unlike children. This means the mother worries about her son's well-being, and even though the monster isn't real, she checks for the monster to make sure her son isn't scared when he goes to bed every night. And finally, student notes that this poem talks about how hard it is to be a parent, since it says, I see danger everywhere. And this is where we move into the second part of this difficulty of being a parent, and that's the psychological and emotional dangers that are part of it. Shin says that projecting a young child's early idea of danger into an adult's worries and thoughts about the future is an essential part of this poem. Another writes that the author refers to the listener as a monster, describing it as a jagged shadow and having musty fur. I believe this is a symbol for their anxiety in being a parent. And related to the idea of a childhood monster being representative of something for the parent, the student says that Schipers uses an ordinary childhood experience, a child's imaginary monster, to represent the mother's heavy anxiety over a child's well-being. And to wrap this idea up, a student says that while any parent would ordinarily want their child to become independent and live their own lives gradually, the transformation from childhood to adulthood during adolescence can often be sudden and jarring. But this poem isn't all about anxiety and discomfort. Students also found things that were really quite beautiful, that there are demonstrations of love here. One writes that the speaker is trying not to let her love become so tangled with anxiety, but in reality, the monster is a combination of the love and the potent anxiety she has. A student points out that she's scared of things that seem harmless but could actually lead to dangerous outcomes. In a way, this is how the speaker shows she cares for her son, because she will always try to protect him. One writes that during the speaker's nightly routine, she kissed his forehead and turned on his nightlight, which are both ordinary acts of motherly affection. Kissing a child's forehead is something that doesn't last forever, as they then turn into teenagers, followed by grown-ups. Another writes that the speaker's attention to detail shows her cherishing the moment she has with her son while it lasts. When she brings up little details like, I turned on his nightlight, or the clothing he wore being astronaut pajamas, it shows how she remembers the night and the attention she put towards every little thing. And finally, a student says that these acts of affection and validation will not always be consistent as the child grows up to be a teenager. A distance starts to form between the parent and the child. That is why the speaker has this tireless fear. And that moves us into a really important concept of this poem, which is the idea of having to move on. A student suggests that the monster isn't really what the mother fears, and says, you might see imaginary monsters under your bed when you're younger, but you won't as you're older. So as we mature, we eventually gain responsibilities and lose our childlike minds. Another notes that at the end part of the poem, the mother talks about how the monster should come down the stairs for a glass of tea and to talk, making it sound like the mother has outgrown monsters, while her son, who's a kid, still believes in them. A student writes that the mother is afraid of being outgrown herself by her son. Her fear may cause her to see danger in ordinary things like unleashed dogs, sudden fevers, cereal, 2 days out of date. From another, they say, normally the monster would be something to fear. She connects with it on the idea that they both have a fear, and it is being outgrown. A similar response notes that the mother invited the monster to drink hot tea and talk about the future, and this might be to show how similar they are, because they're both being outgrown. And along this line, Ashton says that instead of the monster being something the mother is afraid of, it is eventually something she relates with. Eventually, when this kid grows up, he will feel too old to believe in monsters, and will not continue to spend time with his mother. And finally, we move into what I think a really important big idea that's under the surface of this poem, and that's the idea of kind of recognizing the inevitability of this moving on, and maybe accepting it, although that's less certain. A student says that when mother talks about how they can drink hot tea and talk about how hard it is to be outgrown, I think she's accepting that her child will outgrow his imagination and his imaginary monster. Another writes, instead of seeing the monster as something disgusting or something to fear, she uses language expressing sympathy toward it by inviting it to drink hot tea and talk about the future, which typically is something an average person would do with someone they are friends with, or at least comfortable with. Another writes, the author mentions how hard it is to be outgrown. The mother is always worrying about adult responsibilities and says it is hard to be an adult. That's why she is cherishing her kid's childhood, because she has already matured and realizes how fast that part of life goes by. Another writes, it describes the short-lived experiences of childhood and not understanding your parents' protectiveness until you walk in their footsteps. It shows how we grow and change our beliefs over time. Eventually, see, the monster is the fear of the future. I really like that last idea, that part of this poem that's about a mother reflecting on her place and reflecting on being a mother. Part of the purpose of the poem is also to allow us to see mothers, to see parents differently. And I think that's hard when you're young. I'm really impressed that my students can do it so well. Now, there are other aspects, of course, that I love when students explore, things that are beyond the actual text of the poem, and those are structural and stuff like that. Not a lot of students pointed to the title of this poem and what that might represent, but a couple students did, and I wanted to point those out. One writes, I also wanted to point out that the title seems to be third person, but the poem is written in first person. I couldn't find a way to put it in my paragraph, so I thought that I might as well put it in the comments. I love this observation. One of the best things about poetry and poetry analysis is sometimes finding things you don't know what to do with and playing with them, trying to make sense of them. Sometimes you just can't. Sometimes you only have questions. But if you can explore those questions and really dig into them, I think that's where the best analysis comes from. Thankfully, we do have a student that also noticed this and played with it a bit. They write that, considering the title, which is from the son's point of view, he can sense that his mother talks back to the monster because her anxiety and love are the same to him, since they intervene with each other so much. And finally, a response that played a little bit with the structural choices of the poem is a student that says, Schipers also displays the uncertainty that she feels through the structure of the poem. All of the sentences, except one, go across two lines because it symbolizes the speaker's instability right now. She has many tasks to care for her son while ensuring he does not and should not feel scared. The only thing that the author feels is certain is that soon her son will feel too old to tell me his bad dreams, meaning that the only inevitable thing is change. And I love it. The idea that we can get to such a big, massive thematic statement from a single sentence in a single line in a poem, that's great work. I love it. All of these ideas were so well done, and the writing was really quite capable. It's difficult to kind of express how good the writing is when I'm just pulling small quotes and short snippets, but my goodness, lovely work. Our next poem is Message to a Former Friend, and like our previous poem, the opening line does something I find interesting, really interesting. There's a degree of casualness to it, and the word just suggests a degree of simplicity that makes me, when I first read it, expect a quick message, something that could have been a text message, maybe. But the rest of the first sentence becomes far more. The poem also reminds me a bit of one we did earlier in the year. Letter to the Person Who Carved His Initials into the Oldest Living Longleaf Pine in North America by Matthew Olsman, which we explored back in September. Poems like these, where they are written almost like letters, are called epistolary poems. Like that poem, the speaker's tone here is a bit confrontational. Maybe more than a bit, actually. But it is also so much more than that, and this is where the complexity of the relationship comes in. With my AP Lit students, I describe literary complexity as two things working together, but in opposition. These are things that don't feel like they should both be present because they seem kind of opposite, and that they are both essential to how the thing functions. Think of how the mechanism of a clock have different things rotating, pressing, springing, sometimes in different directions and often at totally different speeds. And the clock doesn't function without those many different seemingly opposite parts. Or consider how we can spend so much time with our favorite things that they begin to bore us. The relationship at the center of this poem has that kind of complexity, and I hope students will explore those elements. There are lots of other things that they can dig into as well, of course. Maybe the structure of the poem with these two-line stanzas, well, except for the last stanza. Or the mix of ordinary and imaginary things, or maybe the punctuation in here. It reminds us, actually, that style isn't just for essays, like we've talked about in class. Noticing patterns of sentence length and punctuation and word repetition is important in poetry, too. I'm also noticing that water keeps showing up, and I'm honestly not sure why. What is it doing in the poem? Besides all of these elements that make the poem interesting as a piece of literature, I really think there's a lot that students can relate to in this poem. Losing friendships is an unfortunate reality, and those friendships never seem more fragile than when we're young. Our writing task this week is maybe a bit more ambiguous than usual. I want students to write with confidence. What that means is avoiding words that suggest opinion, like I feel or I think. But it also means avoiding just suggesting possibility. That means keeping clear of words like maybe, can, could, possibly, and more. Avoiding these words will require you to focus on interpretations you can really support with evidence. If you can't prove it sufficiently to convince a reader, avoid it. For our secret passphrase, I want you to use the word simple, particularly because the poem does seem to present some things as pretty straightforward, even if the larger poem suggests otherwise. Our reader for this poem is a friend of mine named Sarah Thomas. She is actually a former Choral Academy English teacher, and she just got married last month. It seems like I could have selected a poem that was connected to that specific life event, but I've actually been haunting her for a little while to get her to do a reading, and I'm so glad that she has. Here is Message to a Former Friend by Tony Hoagland. It is read by Sarah Thomas.
Message to a Former Friend by Tony Hoagland. I just wanted to write and say, in case you are hit tomorrow by a truck or are swept from the beach by a freak wave, or in case your ex-wife decides to take her own life right after taking yours. Or in case you go to the doctor who finds a lump in your neck and you are carried swiftly out into the terrible waters of clinics and infusions, and I never see you again. I just wanted to say, bon voyage, my friend, my dear and former friend. I just wanted to confess how much you meant to me back then, before I learned to hold my love in check, thanks to my tutorial with you. Thank God I got those holes sealed shut, through which every passerby could see my neediness. And thank God I banished you into the frozen part of me where nothing moves or breathes. And yet it's funny, isn't it? Our weaknesses can never be eliminated. Neediness is part of what we are. Living is a kind of wound. A wound is a kind of opening. And even love that disappeared mysteriously comes back, like water bubbling up from the underground, cleansed from its long journey in the dark. Right in the open, there it is, waiting for someone to arrive and kneel and drink from it.
A paragraph responding to this prompt is due on the Friday that ends this week, and your two replies to other students are due the Wednesday after. Students, be sure to use the word simple in some form for our secret passphrase. For our writing task, write with confidence by avoiding words that suggest opinion or possibility. We have had a lot of writing tasks at this point, and with any luck, you are considering them all as you write. A strong analytical paragraph requires a quality claim, starting with a tag, a how, and a what will make that more likely. Use the author's last name by itself if you want to talk about them, especially if you're talking about the structure of the poem. There is again a speaker here. That's the eye of the poem. And we have a listener as well, the friend that's being referred to. Use varied sentence openings and varied sentence lengths. We've got a lot of sentences that continue from one line to the next, so you may need to use a single forward slash to indicate a line break if you quote across one. Some of those sentences even go from stanza to stanza, so you may need double slashes to indicate stanza breaks. And even though you don't have to do it for good writing, some of my favorite sentences from our last responses were those that used two short quotations effectively. So if you can make it work, consider doing that again too. If you enjoy this podcast, have suggestions, want to provide a reading, or would like the class to direct their eyes toward a particular poem or poetic device, leave a comment on Light and Teaches or on Twitter. I am at Light and Teaches. The content of this podcast is used as a companion to class instructional activities, and ownership of these texts remain with their stated authors. Thank you for joining me for episode 77 of this podcast. I hope that between now and the next time you hear from me, you discover and savor a few things that you yourself find quite excellent.